Yeah, ask Professor Tsimitas to say some words about Cyprus, but also in continuation of our very interesting discussion of this morning about the energy sector, but that's his speciality. So, if you...
Thank you, Bernard, and Harry, please. Difficult Greek names are difficult for a reason, so don't worry. Well, a very warm welcome to you all. In my previous life, it was exactly what Werner was saying, but in this life, as of 3 years now, I've been based in Cyprus running the Peace Research Institute Oslo, or PRIO for short. I don't know how familiar you might be with the organization. PRIO has been around since the late 50s, and with a slight degree of panache, I'm going to say that it's now, I think, the premier peace research institute in the world, and I think even the Swedes are going to agree to that. So PRIO had the fine idea back in the 1990s, late 90s, in conjunction with the United States, or the encouragement of the United States, the late Richard Holbrooke at the time, to engage in the peace process in Cyprus. So it was the first international organization, if you like, after the UN to come and settle here. Across the street in Lidra Palace, which was in a much dire state at the time. This, of course, did not exist. None of this did exist at the time. And then in the aftermath of the discussions of the Annan Plan referendum back in 2004 for the unification and the unfortunate outcome of this, PRIO became a full-fledged center operating in Cyprus with locations both in the buffer zone and now in South Nicosia. It was the Norwegian government, though, with others, that bought and restored this very building, which was an old house belonging to an Armenian family, a very very well-known Armenian photographer, to whom the next ruins belong as well. But I think there would be a longer process of conviction of the Norwegian parliament to be convinced to buy the other house as well. And there's not much competition, you see, in the buffer zone. But this is very important, I think, in the sense that it is the only place that can physically bring together by communal efforts from both sides in a neutral area, the UN buffer zone here, and has facilitated, I think, in essence, the process of all those people on both sides who wish to somehow make a difference, if they possibly can. There are about 65, I think, bicommunal organizations operating in the Nicosia area. Anything from women's initiatives to peace groups, specific sports players, children of both origins that play together in teams, musical initiatives, theatrical, and so on and so forth. So this is physically where everything takes place, the home for cooperation. Lidra Palace across the street is run by the United Nations, and in particular by the British military contingent in Cyprus. The whole UN, you might have heard, is about 1,060 people operating in Cyprus, in the buffer zone that extends from the narrowest is 3.1 meters in northern Nicosia, where there were two houses, one belonging to a Greek Cypriot, the other to a Turkish Cypriot, on a very small alley, and they were fighting each other. Back when the clashes erupted, to a width of 7 kilometers outside Nicosia. So that very weird buffer zone, if you like, is operated by the UN. And thankfully, in this conflict that still in principle exists, only 8 people have perished in the buffer zone since 1974. So in a sense, this is wonderful news. In another sense, of course, it indicates a conflict that is very dormant for 41 years now, where we have the luxury of discussing, but also we have no pressing of a reality to perpetuate a situation rather than providing incentives for dealing with it. Other parts of the region, if not of the world, will tell you that if you had a very demanding, pressing daily routine of people perishing in a conflict zone, then you might have more incentives of actually solving this rather than discussing for 40 years. It depends on where you stand. But I think we're going to stick with the with the first option and perhaps the success of the United Nations and by extension of the international community of making sure that this is a quiet, quote-unquote, conflict for the past 40 years. Extrapolating from this, I think we can say that part of the problem is exactly the fact that it has been allowed to last for so long. What this means in turn is that there are vernaculars which are mutually conflicting, if you like, mutually exclusive myths on both sides that now have been allowed to take root over so many years, thus making it much more difficult for individuals and the communities to come together and discuss a future. The generations that actually live together will be perishing very soon. That might be a good thing for some people, thinking that people with a confrontational logic will give way to younger people who perhaps have not experienced the conflict in the past, thus perhaps being more prone to discussing solutions. On the other hand, if we take the lead from the Annan Plan referendum results, the highest percentage of the no vote in the Greek Cypriot community was the age group 18 to 25. And that is very interesting, I think, in the sense that those young people, who might be otherwise very open-minded, were born and raised after 1974, had never crossed to the north and vice versa to the south, had never met a Turkish Cypriot or a Greek Cypriot. They were raised with the official state myth or official ideology, if you like, from the educational system, which is very confrontational and exclusionary itself, and thus were brought up to believe in a monocommunal, if you like, understanding of things. And this is something that we have to fight. We have to devise ways, perhaps, of engaging different generations through different ways of engagement because a different logic applies and certain different arguments need to be made to convince both. But this is the situation as it is today in its bare facts. You have two communities that have molded themselves to believe a specific solution, if you like. And it takes a huge leap, a leap of faith sometimes, to close this gap and come together with the others in a pragmatic, if you like, a realistic approach to things, simply because, given the regional realities, given the international reality, it's very difficult to concentrate on a small, regional, local, if you like, dispute. And even if you do, you cannot possibly ignore the realities around it. For instance, the interest or engagement of the international community, I think, cannot be taken for granted for all eternity. I think some, like the United States, have started indicating little by little that you shouldn't take our interest for granted for all time, simply because we have other pressing realities and simply because also it's a dormant, very quiet conflict in many respects. But the situation remains today such that the international community had at times a more constructive approach, at times a less constructive approach, depending on other realities and perhaps the individual agendas, if you like, of organizations and states. I certainly don't think that the logic in Berlin is necessarily the same as the logic in London, in Bern or in Athens, in Ankara, and so on. So sometimes we need to balance individual interests, if you like. We have got very little to do with the Cyprus issue, if at all, but within which Cyprus plays a role. For instance, the European Union can be seen at the same time, depending on where you stand, either as the facilitator of a solution or as the perpetuator of conflict, in the sense that it has opted itself, although it tries to be distant on matters, it has opted for a specific solution already. The fact that, for instance, back in 2004, the Republic of Cyprus, de facto run by the Greek Cypriots, was accepted to the European Union, provided very little incentives to negotiate further a solution for the Greek Cypriots. The Turkish Cypriots felt very betrayed, if you like, by this. We had a lot of discussion back then whether this was a clever move, whether it contributed to the perpetuation of the conflict or not. The fact remains that the EU has indeed become, if you like, part of the conflict, and today doesn't always help through its stance, not giving clear messages, if you like, encouraging ones against the others. That, in turn, has allowed effectively both communities to turn somewhere else. And instead of forging a Cypriot identity as such, you have the Greek Cypriots becoming more of a Hellenized state, if you like, in the south, and the Turkish Cypriots, who felt and are not Turks by any stance, turning to Turkey for assistance or in their quest for an identity. Simply because in those 40 years, systems have been allowed to take rooting on the island that are very, very different from one another. So in a sense, it's much more difficult today to discuss about a solution, exactly because the positions are so diametrically opposed, and both communities have been allowed to veer away from each other, that the official rhetoric is well embedded, if you like, and it's very difficult to tackle. You see, there's a lot of mistrust, I think, on the island, on the part of both communities. Mistrust is very deep and runs its course through pretty much everything, all aspects, if you like, of the Cyprus issue. And this is a reality that we have to face. So whatever we discuss, be it federal models, confederate models, unitary states, majoritarian states, whatever, they don't deal, I think, with the one fundamental fear or misperception on either side. The Greek Cypriots remain, if you like, with a very inherent, very deep physical fear of Turkey. And they think that whatever we discuss nowadays does not necessarily address this. You see, they feel that the Turkish Cypriots could always be used by Turkey, a specific Turkey they have in mind, as a Trojan horse for intervening in the future as well. And what we discuss today to them is not enough to guarantee that this will not be the case. The Turkish Cypriots, on the other hand, in what is discussed, cannot see guarantees that they will not again become second-class citizens in their own state without any more the possibility of turning to anyone else like Turkey, because it will be a federal EU state with its rules and regulations, with an international identity, and there will be no space for someone to intervene. So I think whatever we discuss today, be it technical matters or not, fail to address this very fundamental fear on each side, which is fueled by mistrust and misperception. This is why we need, I think, to think, if you like, outside the box. Thinking of bridging proposals, thinking of win-win solutions, so to speak, in the Anglo-Saxon vernacular. And although I think the international community, and in particular the UN, has come up with certain such proposals which made sense, still they failed to register because they had to deal with this unidentifiable monster, if you like, the perception you have of one another. This is how we ended up pretty much with the discussion on energy a couple of years ago, or three, exactly because we thought that energy could be the new thing, could be a way of a win-win proposal, a commodity that could contribute to a solution of the Cyprus issue, and serve as a platform, if you like, for reconciliation, providing very concrete gains for each of the communities, but also together serving as a platform for understanding. Unfortunately, we had the exact opposite approach, and by extension, the exact opposite result. What I mean to say is that when these first hydrocarbon findings in the offshore to the south of the island were discovered, rather than thinking that this could be a vehicle for understanding, for coming together, for exploring them together, and this paving the way towards cooperation in other fields, the Greek Cypriots appropriated them and started exploring and exploiting them, possibly based on the logic that we run the Republic of Cyprus. The Republic of Cyprus is an internationally recognized single state. And thus we have absolutely a legal right and a political right to do so. And it is the Turkish Cypriots who are a breakaway region, so if they wish to join us again, please. And then the Turkish Cypriots were saying, on the other hand, that these natural resources belong to the Republic of Cyprus. Yes, but which Republic of Cyprus? The one original Republic of Cyprus established with the Constitution of 1960. And because we, as Turkish Cypriots, are citizens of this Republic, and indeed they are, they hold Republic of Cyprus passports, then we also need to be part of this solution. The middle solution proposed by the Greek Cypriots was, at the end, okay, fine, we'll put a certain amount on the side in a bank in Switzerland for you, eventually, when there's a solution to the Cyprus issue, to get the benefits of that. But the Turkish Cypriots said that's not exactly enough, in the sense that we're not only interested in the monetary, if you like, outcome of this, but as citizens, as constituent part of this republic, we need also to be part of the negotiation as how you're going to reach this end. So in a sense, to put things, you know, very simply, they're both right and they're both wrong, if you like, depending on the interpretation, legal and political, one follows. But the end result remains that even before the rather meager findings now, as it turns out, we failed to grasp the opportunity of using this new thing, the one new thing that we found since 1974 as a possible avenue of cooperation, to use it for a as a platform for discussion and reconciliation. And where do we find ourselves today? We found ourselves in a state whereby it's been 3.5 years now, lots of expectations were built in the part of the public, and the elites certainly did not do a good job in discouraging them. So effectively you had political elites building expectations on the part of the public. And it's a revival of the discussion of 2004, where the possibility of becoming very rich very soon meant that we don't have any incentives to negotiate and share it with the others anymore. And the Turkish Cypriots are becoming further frustrated because they say that this is a natural commodity, a natural good that belongs to all of us. And we're barred from taking part of all this. So it's fundamentally very inherently, if you like, unjust. This is where we stand still at the moment. And because of this stance, and because of the expectations built in the community, it is now very difficult for the elites, for the government, to go back to the public and tell them that what we've been telling you might not exactly be as we've been telling you. And this is for two reasons. One is because of the physical hydrocarbon findings. The bonanza, the thought in the beginning that this will be the hub of the region and the world is simply not there anymore. But the expectations are. And secondly, because this has become, if you like, a chain in the link of the Cyprus issue, a link in the chain of the Cyprus issue. So effectively, rather than becoming the solution, it has become yet a new chapter of the existing conflict. Because the Cypriots have treated the energy issue as they do all the other issues, and they allowed their stance on it to be informed by their stance on the conflict in principle. It is these bad people, it is these bad people. And this has made it very, very difficult at the moment to change the vernacular, if you like, and think of something else. We have also shown ourselves to be very impractical-minded, in the sense that when this whole discussion came up, and with the possibility of energy reserves and all, somehow being exploited in the future, the immediate question that comes up is, who is going to exploit them? Who's going to pay the bill for them? How are they going to be transported? Where? What is the market? Who's the supplier? Who is the intermediary? And since, of course, it is neither of the states on the island or the entities on the island, nor any of the other states around that would physically have to cover the financial expense, you need to have a business model. You need to present it to those people who will actually pay the bill. That is, the big oil companies abroad. But the way things have been pursued, not only in Cyprus, but in the region, Israel itself, Egypt, other countries, make it very, very difficult for international companies to be truly interested in the region. And in the absence of enough quantities to legitimize this, it is further more complicated. It is not only the legal frameworks, the regulatory frameworks, the corruption, the taxation policies which are problematic, but you have things, for instance, like in Israel now, which holds much more as a potential, the regulatory authority breaking up the two companies that run, in its mind, a monopoly. And those companies now are withdrawing their bid for Israel to start with, which really has much more potential. And so the discussion is not who is going to exploit it, but if we find anyone to exploit it. And for a big state and wealthy state otherwise, like Israel, that's less of a concern. But in the case of Cyprus, that was desperate, if you like, in an economic crisis, in a political crisis, to find investors, it stuck with that. It also missed the opportunity of using this as a political platform for reconciliation. And so I think it's a shame that we might be passing on a wonderful opportunity that came around. Granted, the process is still ongoing. They're trying to dig other energy fields around. But the official rhetoric is that we start from the bigger ones, then go to the big ones. Forgive me, but this is simplistic. We start from the ones that hold the highest potential. If you're a commercial company, that's what you do. And then if you're not successful, go to the rest. At the moment, to give you a comparative figure, if you like, what is certified, as found, is 4.5 BCM, which is a trillion cubic meter of gas, south of Cyprus. That wouldn't mean much as a number, but imagine that in order to run a liquefaction plant on the island, which was the clear priority of the government, you'd need at least 8. Nothing. This amount in itself does not warrant, from the part of the international companies, any attention to come and drill, because simply it's too little. But if you turn it the other way around on its head and say that this meager quantity would be enough to provide absolutely free electricity for the whole island for 120 years from now, then you're talking about a very big thing. In an island that, mind you, pays the highest electricity bills in the whole of Europe, not the EU, Europe, the whole thing. Now, this is not a small thing to do. But because the political stance behind it was what I think was very problematic, we missed this opportunity to present it as such. Until 3 years ago, there was nothing. And then we had this gift that would provide this wonderful free electricity. But no, the political argument was, how can we use this in order to become a hub and have this illusion of grandeur and all? And how can we also use it politically to get back at that damn Turkey over there, where we gain the upper hand again, financial robustness, this and that? If you did not start from that point, then you would have seen that the easiest way out would be a pipeline to Turkey, using the existing pipeline systems in Turkey to go to Europe or anywhere. That is the time when we thought there was more. I insist on this because things might be changing now. But the political, I think, stance was, what is the best solution short of the best solution? And if this is the case, then I think that's how we might have missed the opportunity. An opportunity that was very much supported by the international community for different reasons, by the United States for their wrong reasons, simply because they wanted to use this as an opportunity for reconciliation on the island, which would also bring cooperation between Israel and Turkey eventually and promote U.S. interests in the area. You had U.S. companies very interested in building that. They had already bid. There were two Turkish companies that had already been in taking up the whole cost. But politically speaking, this was a no-no for the Republic of Cyprus. Because the vernacular was that there is a political problem, we don't recognize each other. Unless we have a solution to the Cyprus issue, no question about it. Short of thinking, what if this is the solution to the Cyprus issue itself? If we can use this to take things further, the end result remains that it didn't happen. So today we're back to square one, if you like, regarding that particular thing. But not really to square one, back to square minus two, because we have allowed this energy to become a new chapter in the existing conflict, adding, if you like, to the conflict as such. And then things change. And they think things change very dramatically. The oil prices have plummeted, which means that very few companies could now see it as viable. The markets have changed. Australia within 2015 will be opening new liquefaction plants, so will Canada. So the market in Southeast Asia, which would be the market for this gas, is vanishing, because these people can get it for much cheaper from the Australian and Canadian plants. So the end result becomes, we have a little bit of gas here, yes, which is actually a lot for the island. How can we rethink this whole situation? How can we rethink it along regional lines? To say, forget about the grand scheme, I'm sorry, it didn't happen, it's all right. Still, can we use it for economic benefits, for political benefits, for strategic benefits, for forging alliances with others here? And allow others also to use it in the domestic discussions as a legitimizing factor. I think that Mr. Erdogan at the moment has very little incentives to negotiate a solution to the Cyprus issue himself. But at a certain point in time, when the energy was coming up, he could use it, because Erdogan doesn't really care about, I think, Cyprus. I mean, you know better than I do. I think he made it very clear, even from the beginning of his premiership, that Cyprus was not, for his government, a priority. But he was never going to give back or up Cyprus just like that. So you could use it as a wonderful incentive in the domestic discussion for him. Energy, Turkey is the most energy-hungry country in the region. Turkey pays $67 billion a year to import energy. It's a very big thing. Energy accounts for 27% of its external deficit. So it's a huge incentive. And of course, what do we have now? We have him negotiating deals with Mr. Putin, with whom they see eye to eye for other reasons, of course, very particular individuals. But Russia is going to build two, or possibly three, or one is Japanese, I think, nuclear plants in Turkey, one just across here. So there's a lot of discussion, environmental and other, at a tag of $20 billion each. Then you have very cheap gas deals done between the two to import energy. I don't think that Mr. Erdogan, combining this with the very cheap oil he gets from the Kurds, with the possibility of having negotiated things with the Islamic State and all that, would have any incentive to negotiate a solution to the Cyprus issue. And beyond energy, in the past, the European Union possible membership would also have been a nice incentive. Later on, when he wanted to become president, he also needed something. Now he doesn't. To me, I mean, I might be wrong very well, but I don't see any concrete incentive for him to negotiate a solution. So we say sometimes this banal thing that the Cyprus issue is a history of lost opportunities, but I don't think it's so banal. It's actually what happens all the time. We have a perpetuation of the conflict. Every time the discussion is, we're waiting for the elections in the other side. We're waiting for the election on this side. And now we had the elections, of course, on both sides. And now we have an issue. And the issue is that, especially for the Greek Cypriots, you cannot count on the problematic person in the north anymore to provide automatically the solution. Now you have to come and face the issue. And if you're going to be the difficult one, then expose yourself for being the difficult one. If you're not, then a solution might as well come up. I'm not saying that Mr. Akinji is either willing or able immediately to effect a solution. He's certainly better news than his predecessors, because in principle he does not oppose a solution as others might have in the past. But it physically means now that if the opportunity is there, everybody has to show his or her true colors. And I think this is the discussion that we're going to have in the near future. To what extent will the political leaderships on the island be able to come up with a concrete, an objective, and logical alternative to present to the people? And if we pass that stage, then to what extent will the people be receptive to this? To what extent are they willing and able to convince themselves to vote for something that that will bring a new era on the island? Mm-hmm. Having said that, I don't think that we should also concentrate, not only concentrate on the possible referendum, but also the day after. Because what is discussed now, if I understand it correctly, is a model which is much looser even than the Bosnian one. Mm-hmm. And this is so in order to accommodate somehow two diametrically opposed stances and invite two communities to be pretty much the masters of their own affairs and only introduce an umbrella institution on top to represent them. But don't fool ourselves. I mean, the challenges will be enormous the next day to see how this thing is not a monster, but it actually works. It works internally and it works externally.
In Bosnia, it doesn't work.
Yes, it faces some challenges.
Why try something which does not work?
Because that's the only thing that we have found in 40 years to have the elites, at least the leaderships, prone to discuss.
Actually, we came here to hear the optimistic sign after all the pessimistic signs the Deutsche Welle said wrote today that it is a window of opportunity. Yeah.
First of all, the Deutsche Welle is a very respectable paper, so I think, you know, who am I to challenge that? But my definition of an optimist or a pessimist is a pessimist is an informed optimist. So, but jokes aside, I think the challenges are there. I don't think we should be enthusiastic beyond beyond control. But indeed, things have changed in the sense that, as I say, in principle, there's a leadership now in the north that wishes to have a solution, that wishes to have a Cypriot solution, and that I stress. Akin G was elected on this card, and I think he really means it, if you like. The challenge is beyond him. Not only if he will be allowed by Turkey and others to do it, Britain as well, within brackets or not, but also if he's going to be met with the enthusiasm, a pragmatic enthusiasm on the other side, if they're going to deliver as well. So I would be cautiously optimistic, but with the stress on the caution.
But you say Britain as well. Because I think people don't know the role of Britain at this moment.
The United Kingdom has a physical presence on the island. It's two bases, which are sovereign bases, sovereign territory of the United Kingdom. So the British, even when the entry to the European Union happened back in 2004, interjected in the former treaty that these bases will remain forever as British sovereign bases. Now, this is perhaps the success of British diplomacy, but the end result remains that on the island, it's not only the Turks, the Turkish Cypriots, and the Greek Cypriots, you also have physical bases of Britain. So Britain, in a sense, finds it more easily to accommodate this existence within a conflict environment rather than an otherwise duly construed state. I'm not going to say unitary because that has other connotations. And now the discussion is, of course, about the military build-up on the island, because those bases are not only sovereign territory of Britain, but they're two actual bases, air bases, naval bases, and military bases. And so on this little island, you have a Greek Cypriot army, a Turkish Cypriot army, a Greek army, a Turkish army, a British army, those acting as NATO bases for bombing of the IS and so on and so forth. And now, through the new agreement signed by President Anastasiadis in Moscow, you have naval facilities for Russia in Limassol Airport. That is a nice way of paving the way towards establishing naval bases that Russia lost in Syria. It's quite congested, no? Yeah. So, of course, when you have all this military presence, things can very easily flare up on things that have got nothing to do with Cyprus. But if Cyprus yet again becomes the conflict platform for East-West confrontation, it can easily...
It was always called a non-sinking aircraft carrier.
Yeah, exactly. Non-sinking, I'm not sure anymore, because it's a financial crisis, but...